Hello and welcome to the Library Cafe, a weekly program of table talk with scholars and librarians about books, ideas, and the circulation of knowledge. I'm your host, Thomas Hill. Our guest today is Jeffrey Walker, professor of geology at Vassar College, who's here to talk with us about the life and work of the author and naturalist John Burroughs, and about his new edition of Burroughs' book, Signs and Seasons, published this year by Syracuse University Press. Welcome, Jeff.
Thank you very much.
Although I may be wrong, many of our radio listeners who grew up here in the Hudson Valley know who Burroughs was, since Ulster County was, for much of his life, Burroughs' home and the subject of most of his writing. At one time, however, John Burroughs was a household name to the American reading public in general, since his essays appeared with regularity in the most widely circulated magazines of the 19th and early 20th century, including the Atlantic Monthly, Lippincott's, Scribner's, over a period spanning, what, over 60 years,
60
I think.
Years, yeah. Yes.
From the late 1860s to the early 1920s, which he would then republish in collections of essays in book form, as he did with Signs and Seasons. And he was not only widely read, but he was actually sought out for companionship by people like Henry Ford.
Yeah, I mean, they were both farm boys, and so they got along that
okay.
way.
Okay. Yeah. And in fact, during a trip out west in which he accompanied Teddy Roosevelt, it was said that it was difficult to tell which man was the most popular with the crowds that would gather at the whistle stops. Schools and mountains were named after him. He was visited so often at his home Riverby in West Park by a host of people from Thomas Edison to Oscar Wilde that he built a second, more remote house, slab sites, to provide the privacy he needed to write. Unfortunately, his popularity began to wane shortly after his death in the 1920s, so that for a long time now, Burroughs hasn't been read nearly as much as other nature writers such as, well, Thoreau, John Muir, Rachel Carson, Aldo Leopold, Wendell Berry, and more recently, Edward Abbey and Barry Lopez. And surprisingly, if you check the article on nature writing in the Wikipedia, you'll find Burroughs isn't even mentioned, which is a bit of a shock given his one-time popularity and his critical reputation. And I wonder if you have any thoughts on why this eclipse of his reputation.
Well, first of all, he is well known in the Hudson Valley because of slab sites.
Yeah, he is.
He built that in the late 19th century, and many people have been there. Not many people know that Riverby, his actual home, was almost right across the street from there, but he never had very many guests there. There's lots of ideas about why his star sort of eclipsed after he died. One of them has to do with the fact that Muir and people like him were talking about big mountain, trackless wilderness kinds of nature.
Yosemite and Yellowstone.
Yellowstone, Alaska. And that more captured the imagination of the conservationist nature writing readers at the time. And so, you know, the Sierra Club, you know, became very, very popular. And so Burroughs really emphasized the nature that you see right outside your door. And that was, you know, in fact, he says in one of his essays in the book here that the walk you take today should be the walk you took yesterday, because you will have changed, everything else will have changed. This is the way, this is the kind
this
of nature
method,
that he
yeah.
wanted people to look for. Another idea about why his star might have eclipsed a little, and this is something that I began to wonder about as I was working on the book, is it might have been the fact that there was a huge readership that had grown up with Burroughs.
Uh-huh.
Over 60 years, people had watched, had read him a lot. He changed a lot, and he was very honest, and he was willing to write about things that, even if 10 years ago he'd written one thing about it, he's willing to change his mind.
Mm-hmm.
He's willing to go back and talk about it and say why he changed his mind.
Uh-huh.
And he let people really into his life and his mind. These were mostly published, as you say, in magazines.
Yeah.
And then brought into books. And by the time he died, he had 22 books.
Yeah.
It was this huge, huge bookshelf. And after he died, you couldn't say, okay, I'm going to read John Muir, so I'll read Summer in the Sierra, one book. Or you couldn't read Walden, you know. You had to get 22 books.
Yeah.
You had to figure out which one of the 22 books to
yeah,
get
I
to
see.
Do. Coupled with that was the fact that, you know, most of the articles that he published were, you know, these kinds of essays in these kinds of magazines are relatively ephemeral.
Yeah.
And so I think people more knew him through his magazine articles than through his books.
Yeah.
And after he quit publishing the books, they kind of forgot, you know, that he was there. Other authors may have come along. So I think it's probably a combination of those three things.
I wonder if his audience changed also. The nature of society changed. The age he grew up in, the Gilded Age, was an age of turmoil and upheaval in some ways for most people, and he offered a version of nature that had to do with reality, certainly, but it allowed them to engage reality in a way that the sort of pressures of life wouldn't. And then, say, after the First World War, people didn't want to engage reality at all, whether in nature or any other way. They wanted some kind of escape or at least shock, and it seems, I wonder.
Well, and his later writings reflected that.
Yeah.
His later writings were much more introspective and much more wondering about the place of humans in the universe. And it wasn't that his style changed so much, but he became a little more formal and a little more kind of opaque.
Yeah.
His early writings, and especially represented in Signs and Seasons, are just, you know, optimistic and friendly and happy, and, you know, you just felt like, you know, he was your friend.
Yeah.
In fact, one of his biographies was Our Friend, John Burroughs, by Clara Barris. Uh-huh. But then after the last decade of his life, 1910, 1920, many of his friends started dying. Much of his family passed away. His wife passed away 2 or 3 years before he did. You know, all of a sudden, he was beginning to really feel his mortality, and his writings began to take on that more kind of dark.
He wrote more philosophical works to some extent, at least openly philosophical.
Yes, right.
Yeah. The public does seem to have an interest in nature now, and you wonder if that might help a resurgence of interest in Burroughs. But our ideas of nature, at least as you see nature represented, say, on the Animal Planet or Discovery Channel, is entirely different. And you wonder if Burroughs would even recognize it. Nature isn't a lion attacking an antelope or a crocodile eating a wildebeest. It's either sensation and horror on the one hand, or it's cute on the other, and there doesn't seem to be any real... It seems to be motivated almost by kind of fear of nature.
Maybe he wouldn't. I hadn't ever thought about that. But he was interested in the familiar in nature, and so things that are more exotic. He did travel. He traveled to the Caribbean, traveled to Hawaii, traveled all around the West and Alaska, traveled to Europe, at least to England. But all the times that he was traveling, wherever he went, he always was thinking about what it was like at home.
Yeah.
For instance, he went to Alaska with the Harriman Expedition in the 1890s, and he stopped in Sitka, I think it was, to buy eggs from this. I mean, you know, they stopped in Sitka. He was walking around. He bought some eggs. Well, he talks about, you know, the flowers that were blooming in this lady's garden, and he said, you know, I know that back home, you know, such and such is blooming, but here I see this is blooming and things. He did the same thing when he went to England. He saw them making hay, and he compared the way that they were making hay to the way they make hay in the Catskills. He was always thinking of his home and comparing what the nature he was in with the more familiar nature of his home.
Yeah.
In fact, he went to Jamaica, I think it was, and he wrote an essay. He called it A Wasted April.
Oh, really?
He hated it.
And
maybe because of that. It was a tropical area, at least at that time, a tropical climate, tropical vegetation. There was nothing he could recognize.
Yeah.
There was hardly any farming that was never recognizable to him. There was no vegetation. There were no birds that he could recognize.
Yeah.
And he felt completely out of his element. Yeah. So he was much more comfortable and more optimistic when he was in his among his familiar thing.
Perhaps your book and several other titles that have come out since the new millennium are signs that there's a beginning of a resurgence of interest in Burroughs, especially as we're coming to see that social and environmental threats are bound up closely together and that the path out of these problems might involve the cultivation of a different kind of attitude toward the world. I can see Burroughs possibly as a future influence in the way we relate to things.
That's definitely where I think his real relevance to the current world is. The kind of nature that almost everybody in the world is going to experience is the nature right outside their door. And there'll be fortunate folks that will be able to travel to Antarctica and Patagonia and Alaska and all kinds of places where there really is untrammeled wilderness, but they'll spend most of their life living in a city or in the country or something like that and having this nature around them.
Yeah.
It seems to me that being able to appreciate both is really, really important. It seems, at least a truism, that the nature that you know the best is the nature that you will work hard to protect in one way or another.
Very much.
And so that's where I think that Burroughs has a lot to say I do like to think that there is some kind of resurgence, and I hope that this book is part of a resurgence. There's been, in the last 25 years, lots of different anthologies of his work that show various aspects of it. I was hoping with this to take a snapshot of all of the aspects at one point in his life, 1886, and see kind of what he was thinking, not only about birds and nature, but about philosophy.
Yeah.
That would come later.
Yeah.
One thing I tried to do in this book, if I can put in a plug about the book,
Sure.
is to deal with the question of the 22 volumes of essays that he published by the time he died. And that is, with each of these essays, I've tried to choose a theme within his essay and give the reader a little roadmap. You know, if you want to figure out where that idea came from, here's some essays, you know, they wrote before that. If you want to figure out where it went over the next 50 years or 40 years, here's a little roadmap to do that.
And so I like the way you put your commentaries at the end on each individual essay in the book, and you preserve the original text, which was nice also.
Right.
Was that the Riverby edition that you used?
It's not the Riverby edition. It's a Riverside edition, which
Okay.
is not... Oh, no, the text is from the Riverby edition.
Is it okay?
It was very hard. I mean, for the few years, right around the time that Burroughs died, a whole bunch of different versions came out, all published by the same publisher, Houghton Mifflin, but some from Riverside Press in Cambridge and some from Houghton Mifflin in
New York. Old typeface is nice anyway. It's almost part of the reading experience for me because it sets you in the time to some extent.
Yes.
So I'd like to look closely at Signs and Seasons, of course, but before we do, I wonder if you could just say a few more words about Burroughs' life up until the time that he moved to West Park and built Riverby.
Okay.
He was raised on a dairy farm.
Yes. Born on a dairy farm in the western Catskills near Roxbury. By the time he was 18, he had not that much schooling. There was a one-room schoolhouse in the neighborhood that they all went to. In fact, Jay Gould, who was his kind of like his neighbor in the area, also went to the same school.
And they were lifelong friends, also.
Yes, they were, He really, really liked books, and he liked reading. And this was really different. His family did not. The only book that they had was the Bible, and then there was several church magazines or church newspapers that his father got, and that was it. In fact, it said that almost nobody in his family ever even read any of his
works.
Any of his writing,
also.
Which must have also been a little depressing for him. But so when he was 18, he got a job as a school teacher. And down in the area, which is now covered by the Ashokan Reservoir. And he moved down there, and he spent the next few years teaching at one-room schoolhouses in the Hudson Valley. He actually went as far west as Illinois one time. Never kept these jobs very long, and I'm not sure what that means, if that was...
Well, it was hard to live as a teacher in those days, wasn't it? Especially, he married, and part of life as a teacher.
He got married relatively young, but the teacher's salary wasn't enough to live on. So she lived at her parents' house, and he went around teaching school. And it was not a very satisfying relationship. And so finally, about 1860, he moved to Washington, D.C. And somebody had told him that there were lots of opportunities because of the Civil War. And so he moved down there, got a job as a... Well, he had a couple of little, you know, kind of part-time jobs. But he finally got a permanent job working for the Treasury Department, sitting in front of this bank vault, guarding the bank vault. And basically, he wasn't really an armed guard. He was just a person there to make sure that whoever went in was supposed to go in and, you know, and keep track of who went in. The good thing about it was full-time work. It was enough money that he could then bring his wife down, Ursula. And so she moved down. They actually bought a house and lived right near the Capitol. He used to say that Uncle Sam was a real easy boss because he didn't have to do anything except sit there all day. And so that's when he started to write.
And he met Whitman at this time, was also a government employee in the Bureau of Indian Affairs, I think.
I think it was the same kind of position.
Yeah.
And Whitman was a great influence on his life. His earliest influence was Ralph Waldo Emerson. And in fact, the first essay that he ever published was so Emersonian in its feel. It was published under a pseudonym, but the editor of the magazine had to have his staff check through Emerson to make sure it wasn't plagiarized. And so he took to that style. The problem with the style is it was relatively thick. as is Emerson, I gather. And what Whitman did is said, you know, come on, Johnny. He used to call him Johnny. He said, Johnny, you know, write about stuff that you know. Write about your boyhood in the Catskills. Write about birds. You like birds. Write about plants. You like plants. Flowers. And so he sat in front of the bank vault and just would reminisce on paper about his childhood in the Catskills. And he started publishing those. And those were the essays that people really started to take notice. He was very much a stickler for detail and for honesty and for accuracy in his detail. And so I think that people, even if they didn't know specifically what he was talking about, they really got a feeling for what he was talking about because of his honesty.
Yeah, there's something very physical about his work that reminds you of Whitman in some ways. Mm-hmm. And then he himself seems to be really wholly almost in sympathy with Whitman's optimistic friendliness, honesty, and generosity, which is part of what makes him a real pleasure to read, that optimism. And it's funny to think now that this used to be thought of as a characteristically American personality, with Abe Lincoln being the most well-known avatar. Yeah. So Washington at this time was right in the throes of the Civil War. The Confederate Army wasn't far away. I'd read that the population of Washington, D.C. in the 1860s was about 60,000, apart from the 70,000 wounded Union soldiers that were spread out all through the city in every public building. And Burroughs, I remember reading, went with Whitman sometimes on his rounds. Yes. Whitman was a nurse tending wounded. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the first job that Burroughs got, in fact, was burying dead folks, and he didn't last one day at that. He thought that was pretty awful. But but yes, he did visit. He did a lot of visiting with Whitman. I saw a lot of the war. At one point, he wrote back home to his wife that he was considering joining. I think this was actually before he'd gone up to the front. He was just considered joining the army and fighting for the cause. And then he went one day up to near where the fighting was happening and came back and decided that he wasn't going to do
that. Wasn't going to do it. So can you tell me how you personally became interested in Burroughs and what inspired you to edit the book?
Well, an emeritus professor, well, he wasn't emeritus then, but Frank Burgon was an English professor here at Vassar. And soon after I arrived, he asked me if I was interested in running for a position on the board of directors of the John Burroughs Association. That is kind of the association that takes care of slab sites and the nature preserve around it. And I said, sure, because I was a new assistant professor and this, you know, older person, you know, more advanced person who I respected a lot and liked a lot, was asking me. I thought it must be fun if he did it. And so I got on the board of directors of the John Burroughs Association. So I thought I should start reading Burroughs. And soon after that, my wife, Kathy, found the complete works of Burroughs over at the Three Arts bookstore. And it was funny because I called Frank. I said, Frank, this is so great. You know, I found a complete works of Burroughs, but I don't know, is it a good price? You know, whatever it was $150 or something. Mm-hmm. He said, well, that's only $3 a book. It wouldn't matter what it is. You know? And so we bought it. But Frank's recommendation was that it was a pretty good deal. And so I started reading. I started reading, you know, from volume one on through. And then after I'd been working on that for a few years, I began to consider this question about Burroughs' popularity and is there a way to try and bring him into the fold, essentially, of currently read and appreciated nature writers? So then I struck on this idea that maybe instead of creating an anthology, which makes him look a little one-dimensional, you know, the birds of John Burroughs, he's a bird guy, you know, or the nature writing of John Burroughs, he's a nature writer. Well, he seemed like he wasn't as easily classifiable. And so I thought maybe the thing to do is to choose one of the books and reissue the book itself with some critical commentary. So I settled on Signs and Seasons because it had three essays in it that I knew and liked, and that was The Sharp Lookout, A River View, and Phases of Farm Life. So I decided that I would go with a reissue of a complete volume rather than an anthology because I thought it was a little bit different and maybe I could be easier to find a publisher, you know,
for it. Does, even though it's a collection of essays written over a period of different times, some of them, it does hold together very nicely as a book. You get a feeling there's a beginning and a middle and an end to it as you read through it. So.
Well, and this is something that, as far as I could tell, had never been considered very much in the work of John Burroughs. The nice essays, the really good essays, had been anthologized, but no one had ever looked at an entire book and said, You know, okay, why is this one first? How does it relate to the other ones, you know? And Sharp Lookout turns out to be excellent in that way.
And he really does think of himself as an artist, as a literary artist. Like Thoreau, I think sometimes as you're reading him, you feel like you're meandering from one place to another, but, you know, when you come away from him, you realize that there's something more there. That there is this kind of control, certainly. And there are subtexts that come in and out that time.
Oh, yeah, and actually, even since it's been published and I've been using it in classes and things, I've noticed other ones that I didn't pick up at that time. One thing I found really fascinating about this project was going back and finding the original article as it was published in Scribner's or wherever it was, reading through that article, reading through what he eventually published, and seeing, you know, is it different? And if it's different, trying to speculate why.
Sounds like a very Burroughs-esque method of investigation.
Some of them were unchanged. Others of them, there were huge changes. And in some cases, the changes were so large in that some of the older ones in here, River View and Roof Tree, they had been published 10 years before Signs and Seasons was issued. Yeah. And especially in the case of Roof Tree, the changes were so gigantic. Mm-hmm. He changed his mind completely. I began to wonder, why did he even bother to dredge this old thing up to change it so much? Why didn't he just write a whole new article? And it's an interesting question I'm working on right now because, someone's asked me to put a chapter in a book about Burroughs, and I've decided to do that, so I don't have an answer to that. But it was very interesting. Some of them slotted right in, no change at all.
Yeah.
Some of them had just little paragraphs added at the end, and it was easy to see how, like in one of them, he added a couple of paragraphs at the end that had a lot to do with evolution. When he first wrote that particular essay, he was still kind of on the fence about evolution. He had a couple of observations that were evolutionary kind of in their character, but by the time he went to revise it, by the time he issued Signs and Seasons, he was an avid supporter of evolution. And so he'd added a couple of paragraphs at the end to discuss evolutionary.
He is willing to change his mind and talk about why he changes his mind, which is interesting. There's this kind of humility about him that comes through. Even though when he's fairly certain about something, he's fairly sure about it. So. And did you feel any special connectedness with Burroughs as a fellow teacher? Because I have a sense, reading through your edition of his work, that the fact that he is a teacher is a big part of what he is as a writer, and that he is always teaching in a way. In a good way. I mean, in a sense that he's not so much hitting you over the head with these facts that he's concentrating on, but that he really is always kind of urging you to think for yourself.
I hadn't really thought of him that much as a teacher. I realized that his life and up until he went to Washington, D.C., was in teaching. After that, he didn't do any formal teaching. He moved to West Park. He then established his fruit farm. And then after, as you said, an introduction, as it became so crowded, he then built slab sides. He moved out there. He grew celery out there. He was mostly, you know, a farmer and a writer were his two things. But yes, he definitely was always thinking about teaching through his essays, of bringing to light observations that he had made of things that, especially about bird behavior, that was clearly his strongest suit, really, was bird identification, bird behavior, bird calls, and things like that. And he was always talking about things that he had observed birds doing that weren't the kind of stuff you find just in a, you know, in a field guide about birds. You know, some new sorts of things. Because of all the visitors that saw him, he was always taking them out in the woods, always trying to show them things. I think you're right. He was a teacher his whole life. But he was teaching by his own enthusiasm, the example of his enthusiasm.
Yeah, I wondered if his orientation toward staying sort of in one place and letting nature come to him, in fact, had been influenced to some extent by the fact that he had taught in these one-room schoolhouses where the classroom was a sort of self-contained universe almost, and you're always talking about this wider universe,
Very interesting. I had not thought of that, but...
And, of course, his life as a farmer played into that, too. And I remember reading somewhere, actually, in one of his works, he talks about his father's generation and the fact that people of his father's generation weren't able to travel much, that it was a big thing to get in the wagon and go once in a season to the general store to pick up supplies. And the people's worlds, people that didn't go off to become pioneers anyway, that stayed in these settlements in the East and elsewhere, really did live in a little world of their own.
Then, he was, as you mentioned, he was part of the Gilded Age. age when travel became much more accessible. Yeah. And in a lot of ways, as the 80s and 90s and early, you know, around the turn of the century went on, he became even more and more defensive about the need to stay home because it was just so easy for people to go other places and see other exciting things. Yeah.
So let's turn to the book. Can you tell us something about the first essay, A Sharp Lookout, which seems a perfect first essay to become acquainted with Burroughs? And it provides an early view into the other material in the book, I think, too.
Yes, it does. So, yeah. Well, A Sharp Lookout, it was originally published under the title Signs and Seasons. Mm-hmm. The title was changed, I guess Burroughs decided that Signs and Seasons fit the book better than it fit that that essay. And I believe that it does. Because in A Sharp Lookout, he spends the first quarter of it really making, it's kind of like a pep talk to anybody that wants to, you know, to try and become an expert on local nature, to observe your local nature. And if you just sit there, all the wonders of the world will come to you. Yeah. And, you know, he was in a good position. In the Hudson Valley, especially because he was so interested in birds, you know, we have so many migratory birds that move up and down the Hudson Valley, so that, you know, in some ways he's, you know, kind of got an armchair seat to all the Arctic birds coming through, and when they come through, he associates them with the Arctic, and he feels that he's experiencing the Arctic. But I think that the essay goes beyond that, though, in saying that it doesn't matter. Yeah. You know, I realize this is a wonderful place I live, but the place you live is wonderful as well, and you should do that. He quotes Gilbert White in saying that the places that we will find, we'll find the most diversity of the places that we study the closest.
The closest, yeah.
And Gilbert White, a clergyman in rural England, not in a particularly romantic wilderness kind of an area, and yet it was this observation was, you know, clearly what Burroughs felt.
Yeah.
So the first part of it was this encouragement for people everywhere to follow his lead. And then the second part of it, he talks about the mechanics of doing this. That's why I think The Sharp Lookout becomes a much more appropriate title for the essay, because he's giving essentially some little ground rules about how to be an observer. Keep your mind open. Always be asking questions. Make observations and see how they relate to your questions, and then refine your questions and make your questions more and more refined until you find an answer.
Yeah, he says that asking the right questions and asking questions is an important part of seeing that you can't really see unless you do.
Right. And also make observations, do experiments. You know, he talks about, I thought I'd hit the tree with my cane and see what the birds did. I mean, and that's an experiment, you know, and it's an experiment because he had a conscious reason. He had a question in his mind. He wasn't just doing it to be rude to the birds in the tree there. And then he even starts to become kind of metaphysical, and he says, you know, that really nature is out there, but by our observing it and by our passing it through our intellect, we really sort of ennoble nature, and we make it really, you know, we actually sort of improve on nature in some ways by our observation. And then finally he ends, I'll look for that, because this is a nice passage that someone just pointed out to me. Peter Stillman, we read this in one of my classes, you know, and I thought, oh, here I'm the expert on Burroughs, I know everything. And then he pointed this out to me. And then it ends.
Which is very Burroughs-esque again. You think you're familiar with something, but when you look again, you find you're not.
So it ends. Man can have but one interest in nature, namely to see himself reflected or interpreted there, and we quickly neglect both poet and philosopher who fail to satisfy, in some measure, this feeling. Mm. So he brings it all the way around, you know, that you know, we observe nature, we kind of intellectualize nature, but in the end what we really want to is see how we're a part of nature.
Yeah, the essay struck me almost as a kind of meditation on the nature of truth and language. And in fact, you realize when you read Burroughs after a bit that when he writes about nature, he's writing to some extent about writing or the practice of perception that goes into writing. And and sometimes he almost doesn't distinguish between the practice of observing things and the practice of putting things into words. He talks in the essay about translating the quaint and oblique language of nature, about the satisfaction that one has from having a name for something, which again it reminds me of the teacher in him in some respects. And he has that wonderful passage about finding the tiny shrimp.
Oh, the little shrimps, yes.
That he'd never seen. He'd walked in his fields for years and never really noticed them. Mm-hmm. And he didn't know what they were. They seemed like little fairies to him. And mm-hmm. he finally sought out a fellow naturalist who gave him a name for
yes.
them. And he was
naming is very important for him. And in fact, that becomes one of the ways that this ties then to the rest of the book. Because later on in the book, in A Taste of Maine Birch, he goes into the Maine woods with a guide, Uncle Nathan.
Yeah.
And Uncle Nathan Uncle Nathan knows a lot about the woods because he doesn't know any Latin names for anything. And so he says, well, you know, there's that plant over there, and what do you call that? And Burroughs is able to give him, you know, a common name and a Latin name for it. And Uncle Nathan, in a sharp lookout, he says, Uncle Nathan felt in some ways that this made his Maine woods sort of better in some ways.
Validated his experience, exactly.
So that sort of a tie was very important. That's one of the reasons I think this was chosen.
Although you could read all of this as a kind of positivistic, poetic manifesto that it would be in time with the kind of naturalism, late 19th century. Mm. But he makes these things problematic always in that, well, he talks about the fact that nature is always fluid. You really never entirely have a handle on it. It mm-hmm. always surprises you. It's a moving target, so to speak. Well, he says dogmatism in nature is always a bad idea.
Right.
So he's very complex in his mm-hmm. approach to language and seeing things.
Yeah, actually, there's one other thing I wanted to mention that came out in that passage I read when he says that we quickly will. Well, I guess I should look it up here. I'm not that good of a paraphraser. We quickly neglect both the poet and the philosopher who fail to satisfy in terms of seeing man reflected in nature. Yeah. This is probably, for me, one of the things that really defines Burroughs and Burroughs' approach to both literature and to natural history. Because he says that, I alluded to it a little bit earlier, in literature needs to reflect nature accurately. He's constantly quoting from, first of all, some of his favorite authors, which were Shakespeare and Virgil. And Emerson to some extent.
Yeah, he's very literary.
He's very literary.
In a sense. Much more so than Muir.
And he says that the reason that he likes Shakespeare, I mean, there's a lot of reasons he likes Shakespeare, but one thing he's so impressed by Shakespeare is that when Shakespeare has a bird in a scene, it's the right bird
the
right call, doing the right thing at the right time of year.
Yeah.
For him, you know, and that's just an example of the reason why. One of the reasons he believes that Shakespeare is so timeless because Shakespeare was such a good observer and a good in representing. Same thing with Virgil. He's always picking out little things from Virgil, including this whole deal about the ants and whether the ants are moving their eggs down into the ground or putting them out in the sun and everything. And then he gives a quotation from Virgil in the Latin. He gives two different translations of it from scholars and says, but I don't think that they're right. I think instead that this is what's happening and things like that. So he is, he's very literate, considering he had a few years in a one-room schoolhouse. He had two other half-year schoolings at the Cooperstown Union Academy, which I'm not sure what was taught there. But yes, he was very literate, and he was very much a critic in terms of how people were using nature.
Yeah.
One big section of Sharp Lookout is all about some observations made by some other poets, some kind of more contemporary poets to him, about the blooming of dandelions and buttercups. And he says, oh, they never bloom together. And that's the level that the poem has to have. The poem has to have the dandelions and the buttercups blooming at the right time or else everything else about it you're not sure.
Yeah, sure. Although he's influenced certainly by Emerson and the Transcendentalists, he doesn't see nature necessarily as just a symbol for something else to convey some other truth in that.
Right.
That nature itself is just kind of a vehicle.
Right.
Nature itself is important enough.
That was what he used to say was the difference between he and Thoreau. He says, Thoreau will give you the bird behind the bird, but I just give you the bird. He claims that he's just giving observations. He's obviously reflecting on those observations as well, but at a different...
He considered himself to some extent and was a literary critic. And actually, as far as Whitman's concerned, he was the first person to actually write a book on Whitman.
Yes.
He was a staunch defender of Whitman's work right through the 19th century. Thoreau also, in fact, when neither writer was really very highly regarded by the critical establishment of the time.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I've heard it said that Thoreau may have remained unknown if it hadn't been for Burroughs constantly calling attention to him. And certainly he was a friend, but also a literary critic of Whitman. The first book on Whitman was actually Burroughs' first book, and apparently the manuscript shows extensive revision by Whitman himself onto it. So
they collaborated.
It's questionable, you know, just how objective it was. But he also wrote one right after Whitman died, which time Whitman couldn't help too much anymore. And it was an important work.
Yeah. In terms of the human element in observation, when you read Burroughs' works, you realize also quickly that Burroughs is always in the picture himself. Mm-hmm. You're never just reading objective third-person descriptions of things. It always reads, in some extent, when you think about it, as autobiography.
Mm-hmm.
Though, on the other hand, you don't feel like you do with some autobiography, that you're just in the company of someone who likes to talk about themselves all the time. He really does cause you, in a way, to be immersed in whatever it is he's mm-hmm. looking at. And to some extent, I think that presence that he always places into his work is what holds the work together as a kind of glue sometimes.
Yes. He's always there. And I think that's probably a reason why he's always there, and he's always talking in these friendly, optimistic, humorous kinds of terms. The only humor he has is laughing at himself for doing silly things, and I think that's why people liked him a lot.
There's a nice passage, I can't remember what essay it's in, but he sets an owl out in a field to keep the birds away from his cherries.
Cherries, right.
And it goes wrong on
him. Right. Yeah. Attracts the birds. That's right. He says that they would come up and they would scold the owl for a little while, and then they'd go eat some cherries, and they'd come back and scold the owl for a little while. So, yes, it's classic.
Now, in the tragedies of the nests, I know Burroughs is critical of writers who anthropomorphize birds and animals, but he does himself do mm-hmm. this to some extent. At least he ascribes feelings to animals openly, mm-hmm. not to a point where you feel you're watching a Disney movie. But I wonder if you had any thoughts about that.
Well, right around the turn of the century, there were some articles that were being published that were ascribing not only feelings but moral sensibilities mm-hmm. to the actions of animals in nature. And Burroughs took exception to that. He thought that was reading too much into nature. He was supported in that by Teddy Roosevelt, and that's where their friendship actually began. Burroughs wrote an article called Real and Sham Natural History, taking to task some of these authors.
Yeah, and these were things that were being taught in the schools.
I think so, yes. They were being taught. Because of the moral lessons within the essays, that made them just right for some of the teaching. And so he actually then wrote a whole book of essays, many of which were not published earlier. This was a book that he had written most of the essays for, called The Ways of Nature. And in there, he has a discussion about exactly what you say, about feelings and birds. And he says a couple different things. He says, first of all, that he does believe that birds can have feelings, that if you drive a mother bird off the nest and take all her eggs away, she's going to feel bad about that. If you kill the mate of one,
show affection.
Right, right. And so, he says, and so it's not such a bad thing as long as it makes us more sympathetic to the natural world. Mm-hmm. But when we go to pushing it too far into, creating these moral lessons out of what's in the natural world, then it's not a good thing. So he actually, not in Signs and Seasons, but in some of the essays that I reference in the critical commentary, he actually explores the question just how far away. Because birds have these things that look like feelings, it's tempting to ascribe all of human psychology to them, but they don't have all of human psychology. Yeah. They certainly have these rudimentary feelings that are not necessarily human, but they're recognizable as human.
In a couple of his essays, Spray of Pine and Snowstorm, he applies his method of seeing to the plant world and also to changes of weather, and they're mm-hmm. both really beautiful essays.
Yeah. Spray of Pine was actually a section in A Sharp Lookout when it was originally published in a magazine, but I think he took it out because it wasn't especially fitting in exactly to what he wanted to do with Sharp Lookout. So he took it out and made a whole essay out of that. In fact, my students just read that because we went on a hike up into the Catskills, looking at various both pine and hemlocks, and they really, really enjoyed his perspective and then actually seeing them.
Snowstorm really gives you a sense of how the landscape and everything changes.
Yeah.
Just, in the course of something like a snowstorm.
Yes. I was working on this on sabbatical, so I was at home, and I was working on that particular essay at a time when a snowstorm was happening, and it was it was amazing. Yeah. 100 years later, you know, here I am sitting in the Hudson Valley, but, you know, in a much more comfortable house probably than his house was, and yet so much of what he was describing and going out afterwards and seeing the changes in the landscape, it was just so appropriate.
Yeah, and he's interested in the meteorological changes, and you have to think that the fact that he was a farmer and he grew up as a farmer and the son of a farmer who was the son of a farmer and the son of a farmer, that this was important to farmers in the 19th century, to be able to predict the weather to some extent by looking at signs and seasons.
Well, that was an interesting thing that struck me that day was, you know, I knew from the weather report a storm was coming. And I thought, oh, well, that's interesting. I went out, you know, and I saw this big wall of clouds down there, just like he described, and, you know, the red sky in morning, during the morning, and all the things that he had described. And I realized, but I knew what to look for, and I knew what I thought was going to be there. He didn't. I haven't checked this. I know now that the Vassar Library has got the information. I could go to the library and look up the Poughkeepsie Eagle or whatever it was called and see if they had a weather report or something. But I imagine they probably published an almanac, you know, which, you know, was as informative as the farmer's almanac in terms of predicting the weather. And so, yes, you had to see the portents of the storm and read them correctly.
Yeah.
We don't do that. We don't have to do that. We have weather every morning.
Now, another chapter or essay that I really liked a lot was Winter Neighbors. Mm-hmm. And again, talking about language and the way Burroughs employs it, you write in the commentary to that essay about the way Burroughs' description of the bird call of the red owl causes one to experience that call in a way that even a field recording misses, which I thought was a nice statement, and it's quite true.
Yes. It was, of course, a necessity at the time. He couldn't record anything, but after you learn one or two bird calls, you have to think of some kind of mnemonic to remember how to distinguish them. At least I do. But, oh, the oven bird is supposed to have a call that sounds like teacher, 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 teacher. And so, and it's right, when you hear something like that out in the woods, you say, oh, yeah, there's an oven bird. But he goes beyond that, and he says, you know, that it's a furtive, woodsy sound or something like that, which doesn't have anything to do with a mnemonic description of it. It's more of a, you know, a total environmental description of it. And I was really impressed by that.
Yeah. Yeah, it somehow makes it resonate in your mind and your memory in a way that even, as you say, a recording could never do. And the experience is much richer. Mm. I don't really know what Burroughs' ideas are or were regarding politics and economics. He generally, like Uncle Nathan, he doesn't like to argue.
Exactly.
Seems to, but except I know in his youth he was a staunch abolitionist. But in the essays A River View and Phases of Farm Life, he describes views of human beings at work in the landscape, harvesting ice out of the Hudson, grain out of the fields, or barn raising, as communal activities that remind me a bit of Tolstoy.
Mm-hmm.
There's a seasonal harmony in these activities that seems to bind people together to work for a common good and that makes them seem a part of the cycles of nature. He describes these things almost the way he describes bees bringing pollen back to the hive. And I wondered about his view of people, especially in an age like, I say, the Gilded Age, when there was such hardship and labor organizations were forming.
He was not very overt about his politics in any way. But he did, in both of those essays and other essays, talk a lot about community life. I mean, I believe that in Phases of Farm Life, it has two very distinct, important aspects about it. One of them is just a description of agriculture in the Catskills in the middle of the 19th century. And it seems that it's very accurate and shows the range of things that a primarily subsistence farm family needed to do over time. But the second part of it is this, as you point out, the community aspect of that work. And, you know, he even says that, for instance, making hay was a very important activity. Mm-hmm. And it had to be done at certain times. And people from all the surrounding counties would drop everything to come and help with the hay. And so I think that these community aspects of farming, and probably with the ice harvesting as well, are very, very important reasons to read what he's talking
about. They remind me of Whitman, too, in some respects, those passages where he almost doesn't distinguish between human life and the world of nature.
A related aspect of that is his views about technology and the effects of technology on farm life, for instance, and the cutting of hay. He was apparently very good with a scythe. That was the one thing that, in terms of farm life, that he was most proud of and kind of remembered as he was very good with the scythe. And a scythe is difficult to learn how to do it right.
And when people are scything together, he describes a sort of competition that will almost
Yeah, and I'm sure he was probably, you know, he was into that. He, for a person who comes off so kind of humble, there was a certain competitive aspect about him. I'm sure that's... He never would have gotten so far with what he did without a certain
edge. Well, Whitman-esque in a way, in that kind of admiration of the physical strength.
Exactly. In Faces of Farm Life, he talks about how wonderful it is. And in fact, he makes a comment about the fact that the line of mowers, the guys using the scythes, is much more picturesque than the mowing machine, the Buckeye mowing machine, which interesting enough, was built in Poughkeepsie. The Adrian's Buckeye was an early horse-drawn mower. And so he says, you know, that there's no machine like a man scything like that. Well, then in an essay just a couple of years later, he says that the line of mowers may be picturesque as long as you don't sympathize too deeply with the backs turned up toward the sun. And actually, the mower is pretty nice because it makes a sound kind of like the grasshoppers that are all around. You know, there was a way that the mower could fit into it. And so he was always skeptic about technology, but he also realized that technology could make certain things easier for people. And he just wanted to be sure that it was a conscious decision, a little bit like the Amish, I think, you know, a conscious decision to adopt that technology. And I think there's sort of the unspoken expectation that you will then do something good with the extra time that you have from that.
There's something about these scenes, especially the ice scene that he describes there, that when you read them, you come away from the essay with the same kind of feeling that I get from certain types of landscape painting, especially Dutch landscape painting. Yes. And actually, the Hudson River School, it's utopian in some respects, but it's also rooted in hard reality and observation. In some ways, so.
I hadn't thought about it, but yeah, it's a lot like Bruegel or something like that.
Yeah, he's very painterly in
it. There's just all this stuff going on.
In the beginning of Phases of Farm Life, Burroughs posits what strikes me as a wholly radical and original idea of human culture, and he often does this. He has a very original mind, in that he turns on its head the usual urbs rusticus distinction you get, at least starting with Ovid, where the city and urban life is automatically assumed to be the foundation of civilization, sophistication, and culture, and country life, its rude, even if sometimes picturesque, opposite. And he states that urban life and cities are indicators of barbarousness, actually, and the cultivated countryside is actually the true seat of civilization. I just want to read this passage, because it is, whether you agree with him or not, quite striking.
Exactly. My students found it this way, too. Yeah.
Where country life is safe and enjoyable, where many of the conveniences and appliances of the town are joined to the large freedom and large benefits of the country, a high state of civilization prevails. The necessities of defense, the fear of enemies, built the first cities. The weaker the law, the stronger the city.
Yes. Well, I think that it's clear when he went to England, for instance, and Scotland, that he felt that this cultivated countryside was kind of the epitome of human culture. And the Catskills, he felt, had a lot going for them, but they didn't have, as he says in there, you know, you have the town nearby, but, you know, and the appliances of the town or something is what he says, you know, that was an important, it was important to have that relationship. But he clearly is thinking that the cultivated countryside, where everyone has this kind of sufficiency of supporting themselves, really was important. Yeah, this deal about the cities, I mean, of course, most of my students are from the city and think that going to New York City is just the greatest thing there is. And when they read this passage, they went, oh, my gosh, you know, what's with this guy? You know, but it does make some kind of sense. That
He was mistrustful of the city, although I don't find him at provincial at all. Mm-hmm. There's just something about him that when he writes about regional things, he does it in such a way that there's such a timelessness about it, even though he's writing about particular times and particular places, mm-hmm. that you never get a sense that he's really, or rarely get a sense that he's a provincial person at all.
Right. This was written soon after he moved out of Washington, D.C., so he might have, been feeling some residual. As far as I know, it didn't come out very much in his writing while he was in Washington, D.C., but it may come out more in his journals. I'd like to start reading his journals now more and see if, look for questions like that.
The Vassar libraries do have a number of his manuscript journals, don't they?
Yes, they do.
Other material.
He kept diaries for a while, and then at one point, and I don't remember what the year was, he started to keep a regular journal, daily journal, and kept it up till the end of his life. Mm-hmm. And Vassar has all of the journals themselves. So someday when I get lots of time, I'm going to start reading into
yeah,
those.
Yeah, it would take a lifetime to read. I think,
well, I think I would choose a decade.
Yeah.
Probably the decade surrounding this book. Mm-hmm. Because some of these are interesting things. When you wonder why he made changes to an essay, for instance, mostly all I was going on is speculation, you know, based on textual evidence. But perhaps in his journal he said, oh, I deleted that passage because it was no good or whatever. And so it'd be nice. So probably I'll start at that in the decade surrounding these essays, because I know a little bit what I was thinking from his essays, and then work in either direction.
In Roof Tree, Burroughs describes the building of Riverbean, and he posits here also a very striking theory about domestic architecture that you can see is based to some extent in romantic ideas concerning the picturesque, but that he again states in a highly original way. And he goes on to ask, what is a house but a nest inside and out? And I wanted to read that passage, a short passage. Probably the most that is to be aimed at in domestic architecture is negative beauty, a condition of things which invites or suggests beauty to those who are capable of the sentiment, because a house truly viewed is but a setting, a background, and is not to be pushed to the front and made much of for its own sake. And then he goes on to talk about this idea of negative beauty itself, which is very interesting. It may be observed that what we call beauty of nature is mainly negative beauty, that is, the mass, the huge, rude background made up of rocks, trees, hills, mountains, plains, water, has not beauty as a positive quality visible to all eyes, but affords the mind the conditions of beauty, namely health, strength, fitness, etc. Beauty being an experience of the beholder. Some things, on the other hand, as flowers, foliage, brilliant colors, sunsets, rainbows, waterfalls, may be said to be beautiful in and of themselves, but how wearisome the world would be without the vast negative background upon which these things figure and which provokes and stimulates the mind in a way the purely fair forms do not. It was an interesting idea of architecture, to be sure. And he does, in Roof Tree, talk about building river beings out of native materials. And
this is one of those articles, the essays in here, where he'd written the original article right after he built Riverbee, and he was very excited about Riverbee. It was done after some plans by Calvert Vaux, who's a partner of Andrew Jackson Downing, and so it incorporated a lot of the picturesque aspects of Andrew Jackson Downing's work in architecture, and he felt that it was going to be a wonderful place to raise a family. And then in some ways, there's this whole feeling that there's these sort of rude masses of people around. They don't understand picturesque, but his house will somehow bring this appreciation to all the, you know, the neighbors who don't know anything about that kind of stuff. This kind of democratizing influence also is going to come from this house. Well, then 10 years later, when Signs and Seasons was going to come out, he rewrote the article quite significantly, because by then it was clear that it wasn't a very good place to live.
He lived in the house for 10 years.
Yeah, and it was not, you know, that it was a very, very inconvenient floor plan. His wife, who was a meticulous house cleaner, was just going crazy because it was so hard to keep clean. The kitchen was on the first floor and the bath was on the third floor, so if you wanted to take a bath, you had to carry the hot water up three flights of stairs. You know, it was all this stuff, and it just didn't work. And besides the fact that it was built on this bluff overlooking the Hudson River, he felt exposed, essentially, there. And so at the very end, he has this little passage about... This was an interesting thing, because in two paragraphs, he essentially contradicts almost everything else that's in the essay. And talking about pride, he feels that there was a certain amount of pride and sort of the seven deadly sins kind of pride that motivated the building of Riverbee the way it was, and it really wasn't healthy for that. Yeah. So he says, unless therefore you've had the rare success of building without pride, your house will offend you by and by, and offend others. Perhaps after one has graduated in this school and built four or five houses, Riverbee was the second house he built. He actually built a house in Washington, D.C. as well, but so he only built two. And this was the second one. He would have the courage to face the problem squarely and build much more plainly and unpretentiously, a low, nestling structure of undressed boards or unhammered stone, and be content, like the oyster, with the roughest of shells without, so that he be sure of the mother of pearl within, which was the domestic spirit that he really wanted. I think there were probably lots of problems in his domestic life, in his marriage, that were not made any better by Riverbee. But I don't think Riverbee was the cause of the domestic problems. But anyway, so it's very, very interesting, especially to think that that's the very last essay that he would include in the book. But I think it was important to him. It was important to him because house building, the original essay, had been published with floor plans and elevations and the whole nine yards. It's a beautiful article in Scribner's. So it was, this house was very much, you know, on, you know, the cover of Life magazine, so to speak, that 10 years later he found it to be such an inappropriate house for himself. And so he then, 10 years after this, is when he built Slab Sides, which is, you know, a low rambling structure of undressed boards, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So he was really kind of anticipating that this change was going to be coming. And perhaps from this time, for over 10 years, he was kind of looking for a place to make this move.
Is Slabside still open to visitors twice a year?
Twice a year, yes. The first Saturday of October and the third Saturday of May.
And it's right here on the other side of the river in
West
Park?
Yes, West Park, right. Riverbee is in West Park, almost right across from the post office on the riverside, and it's private. It's owned by a branch of the family that's not involved with the John Burroughs Association, so it's much more difficult to get to visit.
But the house is still standing.
The house is still standing. Between the time that this was written and now, there was a fire, and John Burroughs' son, Julian, had redone the floor plan to make it a more convenient. His son Julian was an architect, and so he kind of redone the floor plan. But Slab Sides and the 90-acre nature preserve around it are public. I mean, well, they're owned by the association. The nature preserve itself and the hiking trails are open all the time. And then just twice a year, we have open house, get in a speaker, talks a little bit about some aspect of John Burroughs' life, have some nature walks, and have tours of the cabin.
So, last question. We've touched on this already to some extent, but Burroughs was and is sometimes criticized for not taking an active hand in the conservationist movements of his own time in comparison, say, with John Muir, who had a hand in the preservation of Yellowstone and Yosemite and in the helping Teddy Roosevelt build the national park systems. And he has been neglected as a source of environmental thinking among green-minded people recently. I think if you know, read through green literature, he isn't very often mentioned as any kind of an inspiration to anyone. But I wonder if this is a fair assessment of him.
Well, he only had really one public act of conservation, well, one moment of conservation activism, which was to lobby in favor of the Weeks-McLean bill, which was an early migratory bird act. And so he actually went to Washington, D.C. and lobbied in favor of that. He did travel with Roosevelt, and his style was very different from Muir's. Muir was an outspoken, relatively abrasive person. John Burroughs was he could be outspoken in his way, but he was much less, you know, as we've talked about, much less kind of in your face about things. And so some people, you know, supporters of Burroughs, would actually believe that Burroughs had more influence on Roosevelt than Muir did, just because his personality was, you know, more able to convince Roosevelt of things because of sort of quiet authority rather than abrasiveness and things. So there's that.
As you mentioned, his sort of close-at-hand engagement with local environments could be actually a more practicable way of coming to terms with our effects on the natural world, partly because his method of observation is as much, if not more, a practice of self-development as it is a development of nature or an act on nature itself, which is something I would think we have to look to the future. As he says in A Sharp Lookout, one's own landscape comes in time to be a sort of outlying part of himself. He has sown himself broadcast upon it, and it reflects his own moods and feelings. He is sensitive to the verge of the horizon. Cut those trees and he bleeds, mar those hills and he suffers.
One of my favorite nature writers is Terry Tempest Williams, and in one of her essays, I think she reflected the Burroughs ideas so strongly, and that's why I began to think that Burroughs is as relevant as Terry is to nature writing. She says that it just may be that the most radical act we can commit is to stay home, because otherwise who'll be there to chart the changes?
Yeah.
You know, and it sounded like she was, I mean, that's something, that's the sort of thing that Burroughs would understand right off. Hmm.
So for those of you out there living in the Hudson Valley and the Catskills, if you want to become more regionally conscious yourself, one way to start might be to pick up this new edition of Signs and Seasons. There's something about reading about a place that, if the author is an artist of the caliber of Burroughs, makes you come away with a sense of knowing that place in a way that seeing it portrayed on a film or video can't replicate. So I want to thank you, Jeff, for visiting us today at the Library Cafe and introducing me personally to John Burroughs, whom I mean to read more of.